Welcome to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. It's for the week ending September 3rd. This is podcast number 99. I'm Joe Elia. We're back from a week off, and we've got an interview on a circulation study that finds that blacks are more likely to suffer stent thrombosis than non-blacks. After that, I'll take a look at recent clinical news. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. Earlier this week, Circulation published an article that addresses the question, does black race in itself influence the development of stent thrombosis? The answer, apparently, is yes. The heightened risk among blacks, which had been thought to be possibly due to socioeconomic factors and comorbid conditions, is apparently anchored in genetics. Here to discuss the implications of this is the paper's senior author, Dr. Ron Waxman. Dr. Waxman is the Associate Director of the Division of Cardiology at the Washington Hospital Center and a professor of medicine at Georgetown University. Welcome, Dr. Waxman. The heightened risk for stent thrombosis in blacks was known, but your work attempted to tease out whether comorbid conditions and socioeconomic factors were more to blame than race. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct, because one of the notion was that maybe African Americans had more tendency for stent thrombosis because they have low compliance of taking antiplatelet therapy, and perhaps also because they come too late and they are a sicker population. But as you said before, I mean, we actually proven that despite good compliance and matching for their comorbidities, this was became a strong predictor for stent thrombosis.
As a matter of fact, the blacks were more compliant with their clopidogrel than the non-black patients.
That is correct.
Yeah. So what's the magnitude of the risk among blacks versus non-blacks?
This is not really well captured, and you know, we can also capture that exactly in terms of the numbers. But what we do know, for example, if you're looking on genomic studies, that they have a high rate of propensity for polymorphism for a genomic or gene, the CYP19, that is a higher in this population compared to the Caucasian, and that's in the rate of 1% versus 3%, so 3% more. So I think you have some knowledge that for some genomic reasons you can find it. But I cannot give you exactly the rate, because we were not looking at that aspect. I mean, our study population has a high rate of African Americans compared to other institutions, perhaps. But that's why we were able to conduct such a research. I cannot tell you exactly the number.
I understand. You mentioned the CYP, the 2C19, the variant,
yeah.
which. Supposedly makes one less, in most cases, less able to metabolize clopidogrel or metabolize it less efficiently. There have been a couple of papers just recently, and since your paper was published, saying that may not be so, that there was a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, I'm not sure that you've seen it, but it was this week, and they said that the authors
for other medications. That's true.
Yeah.
So this we know it's true for clopidogrel, but it may not true for tracangolor, which is not approved yet in the U.S. And it's probably, we don't know if it's true for prasugrel, because unfortunately those new antiplatelet therapies were not studied also in the African American population. So we just simply don't know. Because most of the studies with these drugs are done elsewhere, overseas, and they both companies admit that they do not have data on the African American population. So it remains to be seen and should be explored. But if, in general, the CYP19 is not affected by, the polymorphism does not affect drugs that are not related to poor metabolizers, then you would assume that this should not be a problem. So I think I cannot give a bill of proof that this is going to be different from in the African American population, but but I would say that one of the things that can be done is actually trying to explore whether with those drugs we have a better safety zone. And those drugs seem to be, against clopidogrel, to be safer in terms of the reduction of central dose.
I see. So in the meanwhile, until this question is resolved about, you know, whether people metabolize it well or what should clinicians do?
What I propose right now, and again, this is, has to be in the manner of a quality improvement or a study, is to, when you have a patient who is African-American that needs to get a drug-eluting stent, he should probably undergo, first of all, a study which would show whether he's a responder or non-responder, because if he's a non-responder, he's probably at a higher risk. And the second option is that just to give them the threshold for them to get the other drug that is approved, which is prasugrel, which is more potent drug than clopidogrel, is another option, because this drug, at least if they meet those criteria, getting the drug, because that was just for the acute coronary syndrome population. And also there are some black boxes that apply to the drugs, so obviously that would be out of the question.
Mm-hmm.
And the third option is to double the dose of the clopidogrel, at least for the first week. There was some study that was published this week also in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that for the PCI population, it may be associated with reduction of stent thrombosis. So these are some options, but I think the most important thing is to be aware that this is a population which is at a higher risk for stent thrombosis compared to the Caucasian population. So, and I think what we are doing here right now is we're looking specifically on the genomic and of the two drugs right now, the clopidogrel and prasugrel, in the Caucasian and the African American population, to again prove that the importance of the genomic part into that. But I think it's only outcome studies that require much larger study population can really tease out whether, from the clinical perspective, those other drugs are not going to be posing any more risk against one ethnic gender versus the other.
Well, we'll look forward to those results, Dr. Waxman. I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Sure, thank you for the opportunity.
Now for a quick look at the week's most important medical news stories. You'd have to guess that the weight loss drug sibutramine, marketed as Meridia, is in for a difficult couple of weeks. There's an FDA advisory committee meeting on September 15th with sibutramine's cardiovascular safety as the number one item on the agenda. Earlier this week, the New England Journal of Medicine published the results that will be the focus of that meeting, a study of some 10,000 patients with diabetes or cardiovascular disease randomized to sibutramine or placebo. Those with pre-existing cardiovascular disease had a higher rate of complications than those with diabetes alone. The industry-funded authors conclude that the drug should continue to be excluded for patients with cardiovascular disease. For their part, NEJM's editors say they can't find a reason to keep the drug on the market at all. Next, JAMA has an article examining the benefits of various risk-reducing surgeries in women with the BRCA mutations. Salpingo-oophorectomy and mastectomy both seem worth serious consideration, but the issues are difficult, and the authors suggest that primary care clinicians familiarize themselves with the American Society of Clinical Oncology's guidelines on genetic testing and be able to refer their patients at risk to a genetic counselor. And finally, a piece of research for the odd water cooler conversation. The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences reports that about 85% of patients with chronic fatigue syndrome carry a viral signature, but only about 7% of normal controls do. The virus in question is a retrovirus, which led the journal's commentator to suggest that it may be time to start studying the role of antiretroviral drugs in this condition. This story comes and goes, but I thought you should be aware of it because those water cooler intellectual bullies may try to one-up you, and we can't have that happening to our listeners. Well, that's it for this week. I'll be back next week with our 100th edition. My email address is jelia@jwatch.org. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. The Journal Watch website is jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. Thank you for listening.